Well, good morning, everyone. I have to say it's a real joy to show up among a collection of geeks where I can drop into geek and nobody will be upset, unlike spending time with the legislators in Washington, D.C., where I've lived for the last 36 years, where dropping into geek is a sign of, they go to sleep. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do this morning. I'm going to try to give you a real quick couple of stats on where the internet is right now to give you a sense of the fabric underlying what is coming next. So let's start out with a couple of statistics. I'm sure you're all well aware that the billion, approximately, or 900 million machines that are on the net that are visible with domain names and IP addresses are actually only a small portion of the total number of devices that are actually on the net at one time or another. There are permanently connected equipment that's hiding behind firewalls, it's hiding behind other kinds of load sharing devices. We don't know how many there are. There are episodically connected devices like laptops and mobiles and pads and things of that sort. So the real number of internet-enabled devices that may be connected to the net at one time or another could exceed 2 or 3 billion. We just don't see them all at the same time. The number of users is estimated at 2.4 billion. That's small compared to the total world population, which means the chief internet evangelist has about 4 billion more people to convert. So I could use some help, any of you want to assist with that. The number of mobiles around the world has really grown dramatically. It's 6.5 billion estimated now. That doesn't mean everybody has one, because a lot of people have more than one. And not all of them are internet-enabled, but certainly 20% might be. And in some places, it's more than that. And over time, of course, that fraction of internet capability will increase. So that will be a major source of internet devices as well. And it's one of the reasons that it's driving us towards new address space structures like IPv6 because of the sheer magnitude of the devices to be identified. I thought it was interesting to look at where the people are. If we'd looked at this chart 10 years ago, North America would have been, I think, the largest absolute population on the net. Clearly, we aren't anymore. Asia is the largest, which is consistent with the fact that Asia has about a third of the world's population. The other observation is that half a billion of that billion is in mainland China. So even though we hear all these things about the Chinese interfering with the internet, which they do, they are nonetheless investing very heavily in the infrastructure and making heavy use of it. So they too are part of our equation. If you're thinking about global services at all, these kinds of statistics are important because it gives you a sense for where the markets might be. And of course, these numbers are increasing day by day. The internet itself, in spite of the fact that it will have its 40th anniversary of design next year, because it was designed in, roughly speaking, from March until September of 1973, when Bob Kahn and I wrote the first papers describing the internet, so that's 40 years ago. It went into operation 30 years ago, January of 1983, so it's been around for quite a long time. And in spite of all that, it continues to evolve. And here you're seeing some of the things that are happening on the net just this year, the most visible of which for many of us was the introduction of IPv6 on a formal basis. That is to say, all of us who were capable of running IPv6 turned it on and left it on, as opposed to the 24-hour test that we did the previous year. So V6 is now operational. It's not widely visible. Probably 2 or 3% at most of the possible sites are running IPv6 as nearly as we can tell. But the pressure, I think, will increase very, very quickly because the IPv4 address space has run out in APNIC. It's run out at RIPE-NCC. And it will run out in ARIN here in North America probably sometime in the next couple of years. So the pressure will be on because network address translation boxes, frankly, will not do the job. They are fragile. And if you try to cascade them, it just gets worse. Finding bugs and things of that sort is extremely difficult. So running end-to-end IPv6 just seems like the right thing. And when we get to the Internet of Things, you'll see why that's equally important. Another thing which has been happening to the net, for many, many years, the domain names were expressed only in Latin characters. And of course, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers and the Internet Engineering Task Force spent a lot of time and energy developing methods for incorporating Unicode into the domain name space. So now we have internationalized domain names expressed in all kinds of languages, or I should say character sets, Cyrillic and Arabic and Hebrew and Chinese and Korean and so on. The TLD space, I'm sure you're all aware, used to be dominated by the country code TLDs, of which there are about 250 or so. Maybe not, that's not quite right, 230. On the other hand, the generic TLDs were only in the teens, like 20 of them or so. ICANN introduced an opportunity to bid for or apply for new top-level domains. 2,000 people applied. There were some overlaps, but the number of unique proposed new generic TLDs is probably on the order of about 1,900. Every one of those applications came attached with a $185,000 check, which is pretty incredible when you think about when you do the math, it's $350 million. Plainly, there are people who believe that new generic TLDs are going to generate a lot of revenue. I must confess to you, I am still a skeptic. But Google has applied for a bunch too, so we'll see what happens. We all understand that the domain name system, as it's currently implemented, has a lot of vulnerabilities and weaknesses. One of the ways of responding to that is to digitally sign the entries in the DNS so that the binding of domain name and internet address is digitally signed and can be verified when you do a lookup. That's being propagated now. The root zone is signed, and many of the TLDs and lower level domain name zones are now being signed, and that's a good thing. Not yet implemented, but very much under development, is another mechanism called routing public key infrastructure. The idea here is to try to inhibit or at least reduce the opportunity to hijack address space by simply announcing it, which is what people can do. They can look around for IP address space which is not widely used and just simply announce it and make use of that, or even try to hijack somebody else's address space. There are ways using public key crypto in order to inhibit that in the use of the routing protocols in the BGP, for example. So that's underway, although not yet implemented. And then the last three bullets here are simply observations about the environment. Sensor networks are increasingly common on the internet. The smart grid program that the Department of Commerce and the Department of Energy started 4 years ago is reaching the point where the protocols that are needed have become standardized, and I'll show you a little bit more about that later in this talk. And finally, of course, mobile devices are everywhere. Now, speaking of devices, it's been amusing to watch the kinds of things that have been attached to the network. Some of you will remember the jokes we used to tell about ToasterNet. You know, someday a toaster would be on the internet and you would send an SNMP packet to say how burned you wanted your toast. And, of course, eventually we couldn't tell jokes like that anymore because at an interop show quite a long time ago, somebody put a toaster up. You could send an SNMP packet to it and, you know, there it was. Later, I think in this picture, the next most recent or the earliest application was the internet-enabled picture frame. And I remember somebody running into my office saying, Ben, did you see this internet-enabled picture frame? And I was thinking, it sounds like something that would be as useful as an electric fork, you know. But, yeah. But it turns it turns out, to be really honest, these are quite handy. We have all these digital cameras because we have cameras in our mobiles, for example. People upload things to the net, and the picture frames download them. So if you have children or grandchildren, you can sort of keep track of what the family is doing. When you get up in the morning, you just watch the picture frame loop through photos that have come up from family members. Of course, I'm sure you all appreciate that if the website that the picture frame is downloading from gets penetrated, the grandparents may see something that they hope are not the grandchildren. So that means security is just as important at home as it is at work. These things that look like telephones are just voice over IP computers. I think those are Cisco boxes, in fact. The guy in the middle is the most amazing one. This is the famous internet-enabled surfboard. I haven't met him. I hear he's Dutch. And I imagine him sitting on the water waiting for the next wave, thinking, you know, if I had a laptop on my surfboard, I could be surfing the internet while I'm waiting for the next wave. So he puts a laptop in the surfboard, sticks a Wi-Fi service at the rescue shack, and now he sells this as a service. So, you know. I also used to tell jokes about internet-enabled light bulbs. I used to go around saying someday, you know, every light bulb will have an internet address until somebody handed me one the other day. It's an IPv6. It's an IPv6 radio-enabled LED light bulb. It costs about $20 or so, and then the controller goes for another $150. It's an expensive light switch. In fact, though, this is the harbinger of things to come, where devices become remotely controllable through a control box or through a web-based interface. And that is indeed what we're going to see. Here's another example. It's a sensor network. It's a commercial product, so this is not me in the garage with a soldering gun. It comes from a company called Archrock, which was acquired by Cisco Systems about a year or so ago. These are little sensors that run on two AA batteries. As an experiment, I let them run for a year. They got down to 2.7 volts, and the system was still working. So I was impressed by that. These are picking up temperature, humidity, and light levels in the house. And then every 5 minutes, they transmit that data to a controller, and the controller relays that data to a storage server in the basement. And then I have accumulated over a year's time really good engineering information about heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. So when it comes time to adjust the system, it's not anecdotal. I have real engineering data to do something with. I know only a geek would do that, but it seemed like the right thing to do. Now, one of the rooms in the house is the wine cellar, and it's important to keep that below 60 degrees Fahrenheit and keep the humidity up over 30 or 40% to keep the corks from drying out. So that room is alarmed, and if the temperature goes above 60 degrees Fahrenheit, I get an SMS on my mobile saying, you know, your wine is warming up. This happened a couple of times when the power went out, the cooling system failed, and I would get little messages saying, your wine is getting warmer. One time I was away for a week and nobody else was there to reset the system. So for every 5 minutes for 3 days, I kept getting this. You know, I got back and the wine was at 70 degrees, which is not the end of the world. It's not good. So I called the Archrock guys and they said, do you make remote actuators? And they said, yes. And they said, do you do strong authentication? Because there's a 15-year-old next door and I don't want him messing around with my wine cellar. So, you know, this was a weekend project to install that capability. And then I got to thinking, you know, I can actually tell if somebody went into the wine cellar when I'm not there because I can see the lights have gone off and on, but I don't know what they did in there. So I was thinking, well, maybe I should put an RFID chip on each bottle. And then I could do an instantaneous inventory to see if any bottles have left the wine cellar without my permission. And I was boasting of this design to one of my engineering friends who said, there's a bug. And I said, what do you mean there's a bug? And he says, well, you could go into the wine cellar and drink the wine and leave the bottle. So now we got to put sensors in the cork. And as long as you're going to do that, you might as well sample the esters and figure out whether the wine is ready to drink. So before you open the bottle, you interrogate the cork. And if that's the bottle to get up to 75 or 80 degrees, that's the bottle you give to somebody else who doesn't know the difference. So these are actually useful. This is a useful thing to have around the house. Honestly, I think sensor networks are going to be very much with us and very much on the internet because they can provide so much important feedback, not only from a purely monitoring point of view, but the same sorts of things can be used for security and other purposes. You can imagine webcams as well as sensors that are detecting motion and things of that kind, all of which are quite common. The ability to remotely manage and observe is very important. And that feedback loop is going to be important from an environmental point of view. Because I would say that we don't always understand the consequences of our actions. And if we get feedback about how much, you know, why did we have an electric bill that's this much this month, we get some information about what choices we made that led to whatever those costs were. So this kind of feedback loop may actually help us do a better job of managing our response to environmental problems, including global warming. Okay, now I want to shift now into some observations about internets of things. I have no answers for you. This is purely an exercise in speculation and questions about what we would do. I want you to imagine for just a moment that most of the appliances that we use at home, at work, in the car, we carry around on our person have been internet enabled. They have IPv6 addresses. And we have to figure out what does it mean to interact with these devices? What does it mean to manage them? Who gets to manage them? What is the authorization process? How do I make sure that a controller doesn't accidentally control something it shouldn't be managing? How do I make sure that the 15-year-old next door doesn't get control over my appliances, my entertainment system? I can imagine walking in, finding entertainment I hadn't anticipated or ordered. So the first really tough problem, and that's why you're a particularly important group to ask to think about this, you think about large systems, you think about architectures, you think about protocols and structures and procedures and things like that on a large scale. It's trivial to do this for a dozen devices. It's not trivial to do this when you're talking billions of devices. So one question is whether in a residential setting, which try to separate this from residential to factory floor, should we have one controller for every device of every kind that might be internet enabled? Should it be a local device? Should it be possible to remotely manage and control these devices? Do you think that there should be multiple devices? Maybe we should group these devices for different functions. One is a sensor network to deal with security and environmental control. Another one is a controller for all the light bulbs. Another one is a controller for entertainment equipment. I don't know the answer to any of these things. And we are going to, the point I want to make is we're going to have to walk through every one of these questions and more in order to figure out how to design and build a system that manages billions of devices that are internet enabled. Who else should be allowed to manage these devices or control them or see them? Example, I think I'll come to some cable systems examples, so let me leave that off for now. But you might decide that you want some of your devices to be managed by a third party for security, for example. You might want someone who is monitoring the devices at all times, even when you're not there. So that means you need to assign them the authority and tell the devices that this third party has the authority to access the device, to see what its state is, possibly even to change its state. Another question is, what happens if you have a situation where you're in an apartment or a condo complex, and now you have a large number of devices all in the vicinity of each other, and if it's a radio-based system, how do you make sure that the right controller is connected with the proper device and not mixed up? And there are people who would be very eager to exploit the possibility of observing and possibly controlling the devices in your system, especially the security devices. So here, this is a non-trivial kind of exercise. Should it be wired? Should it be wireless? Will it be both? And I would submit to you that we will end up with a mixture of those things. Sometimes it's convenient to put wired systems together, but often it's inconvenient. And certainly if you're moving from one place to another that doesn't have a pre-wired environment or have wires in the right places, radio is going to turn out to be very attractive, but it also has the awkward problem that it penetrates the walls and it might be detectable and possibly exploitable by others. Out on the factory floor, this is another interesting possibility. I would guess that there are going to be multiple controllers for many kinds of devices that are out on the factory floor, and maybe grouped by functionality or by some other organizing principle. An interesting question is whether this is a very flat structure where you have groups of devices that are controlled by a controller, or do you have a hierarchical structure where there's some overarching system that is cascading down through multiple controllers in order to manage an increasingly large system. Scalability, again, is a big issue here. What about direct interaction between the devices? An example, in the case of the ArchRock system, those devices are store and forward devices. They actually form an ad hoc network. They're not mobile in the sense of moving around in real time. They are movable so that you can install them wherever you need to or move them around at need. They form a network automatically, and that network changes depending on radio connectivity. So those are often called MANAs, which is mobile ad hoc network, or FANAs, right? I don't know how to pronounce that. FANA, fixed ad hoc networks. these things are quite powerful because in the absence of having a wired connectivity, you have a system that's dynamically adapting to local conditions to maintain connectivity, and that's how the Archrock system works at my house. And then an interesting question, when we think about the internet's design and how we manage it, we know that we've grouped routers into autonomous systems primarily for two reasons. One is at boundaries of authority, who owns and operates this network, and also at boundaries of internal gateway protocols versus external. So I wonder whether this notion of autonomous system would help us in this environment of devices where perhaps a device controller is thought of as the moral equivalent of one of the AS border routers, and it's managing a collection of devices inside its scope of authority. I don't know whether that autonomous system model necessarily informs us deeply of what the architecture of these systems should be, but it certainly has scaled pretty well, and it has allowed us to express boundaries of authority and control and illustrate differences among groups of routers running different kinds of protocols. So it might turn out to be a helpful concept for us to think about. Now, configuration and management, of course, is everything here, because think for a moment now not only about scale, but also about how you get started. How do you actually configure these things? How do they get their internet addresses? Do they make them up automatically? Do we have to assign them? How do we assure uniqueness of those addresses? And certainly, we don't want two devices to have the same address and, you know, have the controller get very confused about whether it did or didn't change the state of that device. And the other interesting problem is that you can't solve this problem solely by thinking, okay, I'm starting out with ground zero, a set of devices, don't have any addresses, and I'll configure the whole thing and turn it on, done. And then the next day somebody shows up with another device, and you have to, you know, do you want to do the whole thing all over again, or do you want to have an incremental ability to add something? I submit that incremental is important. So we have to work our way through case analysis. I don't know how many of you are believers in that, but I am a really true believer in case analysis, because if you don't do as many cases as you can think of, the one you don't do is the one that will kill you later because you didn't think of the problems that it poses. What about auto-discovery? And here I'm thinking about devices discovering each other or controllers discovering devices. If you think about incremental, if you think about devices being turned off and turned back on, you think about battery failure and all this sort of thing, you have to discover these things. And there are several ways to do it, there are more than I've listed here. One of them is that you periodically try to figure out, the controllers try to figure out which devices are present, or maybe the devices announce themselves and the controllers are listening, maybe other devices are listening in order to discover that the device needs to be brought into the system. Of course, there's an interesting issue here about sometimes cases where a device shows up that you don't want to be in the system. How do I reject a device even though it appears to be in the orbit of my control system? This is to avoid the guy that wants to go and hack your network. He's in the apartment next door. He was the rug cleaner who came in and installed a little gadget that you didn't see under the rug, all those sorts of things. So authentication is really important, and you really need to have some sort of a way of assuring that the devices that are part of your system, the controllers that are controlling the devices, have the authority to do that you granted them. So I would submit to you that cryptography and public key encryption and digital signatures and things of that kind may turn out to be a really important element in the way this thing gets designed. We need to know when a device is communicating with us, whether it's a controller or another device that we are supposed to be cooperating with, we need to have a pretty good way of saying, I'd like to confirm that you're a device that I should be talking to. In the back of your head, I want you to think a little bit about public safety communication, because the situation that we get into in public safety communication is mirrored in some ways in this particular kind of challenge. Plainly, the controllers and the devices have to be able to authenticate. Bluetooth has an interesting feature. I mean, many of you use Bluetooth-enabled devices, and the protocols for getting them connected involves typically having a device known, you know, makes itself visible, and you get to decide manually, will I allow that device to be part of the system or not? Whether we use the Bluetooth protocols or not, of course, open to obvious debate, but the idea that there is a way of not of sensing a device but not allowing it to be part of the system without some kind of authorization, I think, is very important. Not every device is going to have a display, and so this gets into other kinds of problems of how do I know what's going on, you know, with a particular device, especially during this configuration process. Are web tools available? Could we create web tools to make it easy to configure these systems? The implication of that is, you know, where is the web server that is presenting a web interface for us? In some of these systems, the controller actually will offer a web-based interface to you, present the system and the devices that are part of that controller's ambit are presented to you in a web-based way. question is, for every one of these devices, it's going to have some kind of state information, and the question of simple ones like the light bulb, which is off and on or broken. I don't know how you tell the difference. I guess you can tell the difference between on, off, and broken in theory by trying to turn it on, and if it doesn't come on, it must be broken. Anyway, having the ability to look at state is important. Having the ability to set state is even more important and more delicate. Who can set what state and under what conditions? Can more than one controller control the same device? How do they coordinate that? Should we be polling these devices? Sometimes the problem with that is it might take a really long time if there's a large number of devices. Every one of you who's ever tried to manage a bunch of routers has already encountered all of these problems. Do I poll? Do I use alerts? Do I generate alarms? What if I get 2 million alarms an hour? Is all that, you know, headache. And then what protocol should we actually be using? Is SNMP an appropriate framework for that with MIBS and so on? So I don't know the answer, like I say, to any of these things. I suspect that some people who have built systems, like the Artrox system and others, have already answered some of these questions. So I didn't do my homework and go and look to see what answers they came up with, but I would suspect that those won't be complete given the significant scope of all this. And then I've already alluded many times to how we avoid the possible accidental or deliberate hijacking or accidental joinings of devices to the wrong community. Now, there are some examples of large numbers of devices that are part of controlled systems, set-top boxes being a good example. I'm going to use Fios because I happen to be a subscriber, and I had the chance to talk to the guy that designed Fios. So we covered his whiteboard with pictures of all the various devices, what protocols were being used back and forth. It's an IP-based system, which is kind of cool. It's possible. Well, here's how it typically works. The cable company, in this case Verizon, I guess they're not a cable company, they're officially a telco, but you know what I mean, provides the configuration for the devices. So the devices come in, they get attached to the net by the installers, and then there's a whole series of boot up processes that configure the devices. The controller of the device is remote. It's at the head end of the system. In this particular case, I can go to a website that knows about the devices under my account. And so once I log in, it knows what my account is, it knows which devices and device IDs it is supposed to have access to, and it presents to me what the state of those devices are. I can see what programs have been recorded, which programs are supposed to be recorded, and I can modify that. There's even some direct interaction between the set-top boxes now, so that, example, if you have one DVR and it's recorded a bunch of stuff and you go to a different set-top box, you can watch the streaming video off of the DVR on any of the set-top boxes. And it turns out they're doing video over IP, which is also kind of cool. So this set-top box is actually are actually interacting with each other. One remote device without the DVR can interact with the DVR and erase things or schedule things. So that's one kind of a paradigm. The Archrock system, which I've already mentioned, is that it's a manually configured device, at least the way I set it up. But it runs this mobile ad hoc, or at least fixed ad hoc network, automatically. So it does store and forward of the content and maintains the connectivity to the control system. I actually added some routers at their recommendation just because radio connectivity was always a little tricky, and they boosted the signal. And then there's a controller that manages the system, provides a web interface. So the thing which I guess I would draw your attention to is that there will be a pretty big diversity of devices that are a part of this ecosystem, and their functions will vary dramatically. So the question about how to organize and architect the system is going to be influenced by that diversity. And imagining a common system for all such devices sometimes makes my head hurt. But I think that there is going to have to be some commonality and surely some standards, because we want things to interoperate. We want to be able to buy a device which should be controllable and make it controllable by some other control system that we got. If we have the right set of standards, we get the sort of thing we got out of the internet, which is a large number of competing sources of interoperable systems. And that, I hope, would be the case for this Internet of Things. I wanted to just draw your attention to the Smart Grid program, because it's another, it's not a worked as in done example, but is a work in progress trying to manage electricity consuming devices. It also, by the way, has to deal with electricity generating devices, and this makes a big difference. So it started out as a system designed to allow devices not only to report their usage of electricity, but also to respond to what's called a demand response signal, saying, we are approaching a peak load. You may want to not heat the water now or run the dishwasher now. However, if you do, it will cost you more because we have peak load pricing and so on. The idea was to allow the consumers to express their preferences when it comes to peak load usage, and to have the devices, in fact, be under the control of the power generation system in order to clip peak load to avoid the obvious problem of having to build capacity to meet the peak load, which only gets used 2% of the time. And if you only use a facility 2% of the time, then the cost per kilowatt hour of that facility is very high. So if you can clip that, that's a good thing for everybody. The Smart Energy Profile version 2.0 is layered on top of IPv6 and some other structures. That was a big battle to get this group to accept the idea that IPv6 was actually implementable in small devices. There were a lot of people who still think that's impossible, despite the existence of, you know, the light bulbs and other things that can do it. It's like TCP/IP. In the early 1970s, everybody said you couldn't build TCP/IP for a personal computer. You had to have a giant mainframe. So Dave Clark at MIT said, that can't be right. He went off and built TCP/IP for a PC and said, see? And the same sort of thing is true for V6. And in any case, there is a big issue here in Smart Grid about safety and security. People don't want remote, inappropriate remote control of their electricity-consuming devices. They certainly don't want the devices to operate in an unsafe manner. But the big problem, as I see it, and the big challenge, is consumption versus production of electricity. It's one thing to have devices that just consume electricity and tell you about it and agree not to consume it under certain conditions. It's something else to have a device that plugs in and can push electricity into the system. In the traditional electrical grid, it is common to have central production and distribution. The system that's producing is trying very hard to stay in sync with demand. And the way the system works is you should produce no more and no less electricity than is being demanded. And that's, you know, pretty tricky, tough problem to manage. And for the most part, it's pretty impressive that it actually works. But as we get into a situation where there is a possibility of generating electricity in a distributed way with solar power, wind, geothermal, and in fact also electric cars whose batteries might actually push energy into the system instead of pulling it out, we have a much more complex control problem. Because it's going, you know, any of you who must know about control theory know that when you have a highly distributed system and there are delays for state information to get to various parts of the system, you have the possibility of making decisions based on old data. This is known to have instability problems. So this is a huge challenge for the smart grid program to cope with an anticipated future of highly distributed generation and control. There's even a lot of discussion now about microgrids or nanogrids where a neighborhood has a power generation capability. And these are all can be decoupled from a more centralized grid in order to avoid, you know, major blackouts cascading through the system. So this is all going to be a really interesting exploration. And those of you who may, in fact, have responsibility for building systems associated with this are going to have a really interesting decade ahead. There are all kinds of questions here. You know, what can the users actually say about the way the devices manage their use of electricity? What kind of information can you get back to analyze your use of, or the way in which your appliances are using electricity? Could there be multiple parties looking at that data, giving you different analyses and different advice about what to do? I want to switch gears now, with your permission. I've been going on now for over 30 minutes, 35 minutes. I wanted to tell you that the internet is under threat right now. Some of you are presumably aware of something called the Internet Governance Forum, which is a multi-stakeholder meeting that takes place every year and has for the last 7 years. It arose out of something called the World Summit on the Information Society. When that first meeting was held in 2003, the question, this was an intergovernmental meeting. And so these are diplomats. And the first question was, what's an information society? And somebody says, well, the internet sort of looks like that. And then they said, who's in charge of the internet? And we said, well, nobody, it's distributed. And they didn't believe us. They absolutely refused to believe that it was possible to have a distributed system of this scale and magnitude that wasn't centrally controlled. So they looked around for who had any central authority, and they picked on ICANN. As you may know, I was still chairman of ICANN around that time, and so, of course, they were looking at us, asking, you know, who are you and why do you have control over the internet? We said, we don't have control over the internet. We support the internet by trying to make sure that internet addresses are uniquely allocated and domain names are uniquely allocated so we don't get tied up in our shoelaces. But they believed that this was control. And then, of course, they observed that ICANN has a contract with the Department of Commerce, therefore the United States is control of the internet. And although there are probably some legislators in the United States who would like to believe this, in fact, this is a highly distributed, very, very collaborative, very bottom-up environment, just as yours is. So this forum, anyway, did involve the civil society, the technical community, governments, and the private sector. So this is a multi-stakeholder activity. The International Telecommunications Union, on the other hand, is an intergovernmental organization which was founded around 1865. It was originally called the International Telegraphic Union, or Telegraphy Union, I guess is the correct thing. Then when the telephone was invented in 1876, they changed their name to the International Telephony Union. And then as other kinds of technologies came along, they became the International Telecommunication Union because radio had come along and television had come along, satellites had come along. They're broken up into three parts. There's the ITU-D for development, And to their credit, they actually do a lot to spend money to improve infrastructure, especially in third world developing countries. There's ITUR, which manages the allocation and use of radio frequencies. And that's, again, is an intergovernmental arrangement. And then there's ITUT, which stands for telecommunications, and that's the standards-making organization of ITU. To be a little pejorative, and to try to be fair, ITUT has had a big role to play in a lot of telecom standards, especially things like ISDN and X25, and broadband ISDN and ATM. These are all kind of relatively lower level and in many cases not very long-lived standards. However, they have not had any direct responsibility for anything related to the internet because we just ride on top of them. You know that old expression, IP runs over everything including you if you're not paying attention. So we've always dealt with the ITU's standards as simply another bearing structure for IP. However, what has also happened in the course of the last decade is that all of the telecommunications applications that used to be done on specialized networks have migrated over to be applications on the internet. So voice over IP, streaming video, radio, really, and streaming video and audio. All of this stuff has risen up to application level in the internet, and the other specialized networks are becoming less and less important. And therefore, many of the standards that ITU is responsible for become less important. And the natural reaction of any institution that wants to preserve its existence is to reach out for new territory in order to have an excuse continue. So the ITU held recently in Dubai something called WITSA, the World Telecommunications Standardization Assembly, which talks about standardization. And they brought into the discussion all kinds of things about the internet. One of the more controversial things was a standard called Y2770, which is a standard for deep packet inspection. And there are lots of countries around the world that would like very much to have a standard way of inspecting all of the packets that go through the internet. So this raised a lot of eyebrows and some concern. The ITU World Conference on International Telecommunications is ongoing now in Dubai also, and it is negotiating a treaty. The treaty is called the International Telecommunications Regulations, ITRs. The last time they looked at the ITRs and had this meeting was in 1988. The internet had been in operation for only 5 years, not counting all the experimental stuff that we did in the preceding decade. So you can imagine this is a diplomatic thing. These folks couldn't spell internet, couldn't spell IP, most likely. They had no idea, about the internet. So it wasn't incorporated into the ITRs, which was a good thing. And for 25 years, the internet was untouched by these international telecommunications regulations, which mostly talked about charging structures, settlement rates, interconnection practices of the underlying low-level transport systems. But come 2012, they reconvened the meeting. And the debates right now all center on language in the international telecom regulations or proposed language which would invoke internet in either a direct way or in an indirect way. An example of an indirect way is to incorporate language in the ITR speaking about spam. Now, as soon as you talk about spam, you're talking about electronic mail, you're talking about an application on the internet and content. Never in the past history of the ITRs has content been an issue. So can you imagine having international regulations about what you're allowed to say on the telephone? I mean, come on. So that's what these folks are some. Let me make sure you understand. It's not the ITU itself that's the threat. It's the member countries who are represented. 193 countries are there, including the Russians, the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Indians, the Saudis, and South Africans. And so there's a collection of governments, some of whom are very authoritarian and who are threatened by the content of the internet because they watch the Arab Spring, for example, or because they see viruses and worms, Trojan horses that are propagating through the net. Their concerns are not unreal. If you're an authoritarian government that is threatened by freedom of speech, the internet is the most democratizing engine ever invented for freedom of speech, and so it's a threat to some of those countries. So they are bringing, those who feel threatened, are bringing proposals to the table which are draconian in their character. I can tell you the U.S. delegation, which consists of about 140 people, are absolutely dead set against the ITR as evolving into a device for the control of the internet. But we only have one vote. And so there are 192 other countries that can express their opinions. In theory, nobody votes. In theory, it's a consensus. The problem, of course, is how do you define consensus? Now, we know how to do it in the IETF, right? We hum. And if the decibel level is high enough, we assume we have adequate consensus. But selling that to a bunch of diplomats is really tough. So we're probably not likely to get there. But the claim is that there will be consensus in not voting. That's probably a good thing, except for one question. Who decides consensus has been reached? And how is that determined? And that's not well defined. So we don't know what the outcome of all this is going to be. Let's see. My God, it's 45 minutes and counting. Let me do this. I'd like to ask you to just look at these bullets for a moment and remind yourself that we all have responsibilities as systems engineers, as system managers and designers, to make systems as safe as we can, to make them as secure as we can. Although safety, I think, is at the top of my list. The reason I'm so concerned about using the word security is it very quickly devolves into a debate about national security. And then you get into things like what kinds of security responses, national responses, should there be? Should we be launching cyber attacks against what we think is a national scale attack against us? And the problem with all of those kinds of thoughts is that attribution becomes a huge issue. If you are not absolutely sure who done it, and you launch a counterattack in any mode at all, whether it's a cyber counterattack or, God help us, a conventional military attack or worse, you better be damn sure that you have good attribution, because if you don't, we're in real trouble. And in the cyber world, it's not very hard to launch a false flag attack. And so you can imagine launching against the wrong, the consequences of a launch against the wrong party are just almost incomprehensible. It even gets worse domestically. Let's think for just a second. You're under DDoS attack. There's lots of PCs that have been compromised in the United States, owned by innocent parties who don't know their machines have been compromised. And we, the people defending some system say, we're under attack, we're going to launch a cyber response. And so you launch this response against all of the IP addresses that are apparently attacking you. And the plan is to wipe out their disk drives. And it turns out we just wiped out 2 million PCs that belong to innocent Americans whose PCs might have information on them that was, in fact, very important to their daily work and maybe even very important to our welfare. So we just shot ourselves in 2 million feet. So not a good idea. The whole point here is that we really are going to have to think hard about how to build responses against these kinds of problems. The problems are real. The responses must be real, and they must be realistic. This bullet about digital signatures, just one comment. Nobody knows what the legal weight is of a digital signature. And so if there's a dispute over a contract that's been signed digitally, it's going to be a really interesting question about who gets who wins and who doesn't win. We're going to need international negotiations on this because there are contracts that cross international boundaries. And this last thing, digital vellum, just do me a favor. If you will look up in just Google bit rot, you will find a rant from me somewhere in the responses about bits that don't have any meaning because the software that created them doesn't work anymore. because it doesn't, you don't have the right operating system or there's some other problem. It's a huge, huge problem, and we have to figure out how to solve it. Now, I think what I would propose to do, in the interest of time and to allow for some interaction, if you wish it, is to skip through a couple of slides to give you a sense for what I am skipping over. I'm sorry? Oh, you really want me to keep blasting along, all right? You really weren't kidding. Well, in that case, let's go back to this digital vellum thing. You're sorry you said that, didn't you? Honestly, this is a really interesting problem. It's at least as interesting as this whole question of how the hell do I configure a billion devices. If you think a little bit about what we do every day when we use applications, like something to create a document, text document, or a spreadsheet, or a presentation, or something, the resulting files are pretty complex objects. But those bits don't mean anything unless the application software is available to help interpret them. And I'm sure many of you have experienced what I have. Occasionally, you'll keep tracking the new version of the application, and you keep generating new files, and then one day you want to go get some previous file that from some distant past and pull it up and use some of the content in it. I had occasion to do this the other day. I'm running a Macintosh. I'm using the Microsoft Office 2010, and I pulled up a 1997 PowerPoint file. And I tried to open it up, and I got back at, what's that? I don't know what that is. And so that was disappointing. By the way, I'm not poking fun at Microsoft here. This is a problem that would occur even if we were using open source software over long periods of time. It isn't clear how to maintain this kind of functionality. My long-term model in my head of this is the year 3000. And you just did a Google search, and you turned up a 1997 PowerPoint file, and you're using Windows 3000. And, you know, it doesn't work. And the problem here is, again, maintaining compatibility, backward compatibility. You can't really do that forever. The old formats, ultimately, you just can't afford to support every format ever known. And so you have crutches that get you a little ways forward. You may be able to write software that translates an old format into a new one. But even that is not something to be relied upon. There's other problems, too. Even if the software is available to you, but you are forced, for whatever reason or another, to run a new version of an operating system or go to a different operating system, that piece of application software may not run on that operating system. So now you have a problem again. Or the company goes out of business and the software is no longer maintained. Or it upgrades the software and is no longer backward compatible. In that particular case of loss of backward compatibility, you go to the company and say, well, can I get the source code for, you know, this application so I can fix it? And the answer is no. And he says, well, why not? And he says, well, because half of the stuff from the old thing is part of the new thing, and I consider that to be proprietary, and you can't have the source code. Or if they go out of business entirely, and you say, can I have the source code? And the answer is no. That goes to the bankruptcy court, and it will be sold as an asset. So we don't have good tools right now as engineers to try to solve this problem. It may, and if you have, you know, this gets worse, you know, does the operating system work with the old software? You know, ultimately, you may need a particular piece of hardware in order to run the operating system that ran the old application in order to interpret the bits of the files, which leads me to speculate that maybe cloud systems will help us because we can run kernels that allow us to emulate anything. So we might have to emulate an old piece of hardware that runs an older version of an operating system that runs an older version of an application in order to interpret the bits. And that's not totally nuts, but it is painful. It may turn out that that is needed. The other thing which seems to me clear is that we may need to have a redefinition of fair use, because you will have invested in an enormous amount of time and energy creating these digital objects. And to be denied their use is just wrong. And so finding a way to say that people who create application software have to provide for the case that there is no further ability to interpret the older files, there has to be some legal framework in which you can get access to something to redress the problem. We have not had that discussion, and I suspect that we're going to have to get the intellectual property people, software people, legal people together to discuss what framework would permit us to solve this problem. If we don't do something, by 2100, our 22nd century descendants will wonder about us, but they won't know much, because a lot of the files and data that we accumulated won't be interpretable. And when I look at real vellum, which is why I'm calling this digital vellum, things that are 1,000 to 2,000 years old, these illustrated manuscripts on sheepskin are stunningly beautiful. They're quite readable, assuming, of course, you know ancient Greek or Latin or something like that, but at least it's visually presentable. I mean, if you know the language, you can read it. Of course, if you don't know the language, it's like not having the application software that helps you figure out what it all means. So this is actually a big deal. All right, let me go to this next one. Some of you, I hope, are keeping track of new technologies that have come up for networking. OpenFlow is one of the recent ones coming out of Stanford University. Nick McCune and Guru Palekar and their team. That's now become commercialized. There are companies that are making OpenFlow routers. We're quite interested in this at Google. We invested in building our own OpenFlow routers and put them into all of our data centers. So we replaced all of our networking gear with OpenFlow capability. It's really quite stunning because it's a centralized design, which means there's some scaling issues, but it works very well inside the data center. And it has the property that you can do a very good job of managing where the flows go in your underlying transport system. So we are able to get very, very high percentages of utilization out of the optical fiber network, which we otherwise might have gotten, let's say, two-thirds of that kind of performance. So it's turned out to be a very, very important investment for us. I have huge respect for the team that did this. I think they did it in about 6 months. Writing the system and replacing or injecting the system into all the operating data centers is an amazing piece of work. There are some questions in my mind about how scalable this architecture is because of the central control, which is giving it a lot of its efficiency. The thing which is interesting, though, is if you draw a circle around an OpenFlow network and you draw a circle around another one and you ask how do they interact with each other, if you can't run centralized OpenFlow algorithms, we're going to have BGP-like interconnections, which, of course, is what we do now, in order to bind these systems together at a higher layer of architecture. But the thing which makes OpenFlow so interesting is not its ability to manage the flows. It's the fact that it doesn't need to use the address bits exclusively as to populate the routing tables. So just think for a minute about a router that doesn't look at just address bits, but it looks at any bits in the packet that it wants to figure out what's a flow. What if it didn't look at the address bits at all? What if it just looked at other bits in the packet and had a routing algorithm which announced those bits to populate the routing table? The routing table actually doesn't know what's an address. The routing table knows I got bits in the table in this entry, and I have a matching algorithm, and if it matches, I'll go wherever that routing table entry says to go. It doesn't say anything at all about whether the bits mean addresses or something else. Addresses are an attractive organizing principle, especially if they're structured in some way so you can collapse the routing table entries. That's a good thing for internet, because if we couldn't do that, we'd run out of memory for the already 450,000 entries in the global routing table. But there are cases where having content-directed networks or content-centric networks using different kinds of bits than address bits is an extraordinarily powerful idea. So these guys are breaking out of an architectural design that limited the view of networking as addresses, as routing based on termination points that had addresses. So that's the real interesting thing about OpenFlow. We've already talked about configuration management and access control in the Internet of Things, so I won't go on any further with that. Certificates have become a very important part of our environment for the use of public and private keys. The problem with the certificate authority system right now is that first there are a lot of self-declared certificate authorities, and many of them are believed in the tables of browsers, for example. Some of them have been compromised either because they have been penetrated or because someone has been bribed or someone just wanted to go cause trouble. So the question is, which certificate authority should we believe? And it's not always clear. You can imagine artificially limiting the list of certificate authorities that you will accept. That means that you have to have control over what the browsers are doing, for example. It's not just browsers. I mean, certificates are used for all kinds of things. So you have to have control over the tables that say these certificate authorities are believable and credible and these, and you know, don't believe anybody else. If you don't have that kind of control, you have a problem. So one of the interesting questions is, why is it that the certificate authority structure has these weaknesses? And one answer, apart from straight vulnerability questions, is that they can certify too much. Think about the strings that you can have appear in a certificate. They're not limited to anything. You can put any string you want to in there, any domain name you want to in there, and have the certificate authority attest to it by digitally signing it. And so the problem we run into is that any certificate authority could say, this is a valid certificate for www.microsoft.com or www.google.com. The reason that they can get away with that is there's no constraint over what a certificate authority can certify. So one of the ideas in the IETF is called DANE, and I've forgotten what the acronym stands for, but I bet a bunch of you know. In any case, the idea here is to put the certificates into the domain name system and to limit the expression that the certificate can attest to be within the zone of that place. Now, if you use DNSSEC, in theory, you have a signed sequence all the way down to the zone, and you put a certificate inside the zone, you now have some protection that somebody can't artificially inject a certificate into the zone that falsely certifies a particular domain name, unless they manage to penetrate this digital signing chain. And the nice thing is that even if it's penetrated, you could automatically reject anything that is outside of the zone. It's a canonical restriction that says you would not ever accept a certificate in a zone that isn't within the zone's scope of domain name. So that's a way of telescoping down some of the risk factors, and that is, in fact, underway. Another thing which is, I think, equally important, and something which has been forgotten, I think, in history, is the use of hardware to reinforce software security. Amen to that. May all of your packets land in the right bit bucket. Back around 1964 or so, at MIT, they had this project called Project MAC, which stood for Multi-Access Computer, and I'm sure you all know about that because Unix comes from the opposing, unitary version of multi-access computing. The thing that was interesting is that the MIT guys modified, if I remember right, it was either a GE or a Honeywell 635. They turned it into a 645 by putting in virtual memory and traps for attempts to touch memory that you shouldn't touch, and also 8 rings of control, which would limit which instructions you were allowed to execute. And so they had a little kernel software, and if you tried to execute an instruction that you shouldn't because you didn't have permission because you were in the wrong ring of control, you got trapped down to the kernel, and the kernel said, who the heck are you, and who are you to execute this instruction? And if you could provide bona fides, then you could execute the instruction because they put you in the appropriate ring of control, otherwise they didn't. So this was a combination of hardware and software working to reinforce security. A lot of the x86 chips, maybe all of them, have those functionalities in them, and nobody's writing any software for them. So we need to revisit that idea. There's another example of that. Recently, chipsets have been developed that change the BIOS firmware to include a digital signature. The hardware will not execute the BIOS unless the digital signature checks. The hardware will not install a new BIOS unless the new BIOS digital signature checks. The idea here is to try to protect the most vulnerable moment in most computers' lives when you turn them on and they download the operating system with that BIOS microcode. So that's another example of hardware and software reinforcement of security. I've been trying to get the guys at Google to rename our operating system from Android to Paranoid. The marketing people don't think that's a very good idea, but my motivation for this was to say that we need paranoid operating systems and browsers that are ultra suspicious of everybody and everything, and particularly of anything coming in. Because think about the major infection problem we have today is the browser, which goes innocently to some website and downloads the home page. It's just a file, and it interprets the file. You know, 20 years ago, it was text, HTML, some images, and pretty innocuous stuff. Now it's Java and JavaScript and Python and Ruby on Rails and all these other things. And the browsers don't know what that software is actually doing when it's interpreted. And if the browser is running at too high a level of privilege in the operating system, which is a common problem, then when that code gets executed, something gets stored down in the operating system, which is a worm or a Trojan horse or a virus or something else. So we have these browsers that are too lax. We have operating systems that allow too much privilege and are vulnerable. We need to work on that. If you're looking for a really cool dissertation topic, cloud computing is in its infancy. We are in cloud computing land today where internet was in 1973. In 1973, we had networks. There was IBM's SNA, there was Digital's DECnet, there was HP's DS, and there were others, and they worked. We even had X25, well, not quite in 73, that showed up around 76. So we had these networks, but they didn't know anything about each other. Every network thought it was the only network in the universe, and that was okay, because the universe was all the IBM machines that you had bought or all the DEC machines. So, of course, Bob and I said, well, we can't have the Defense Department trapped into having to buy only one brand of computer in order to have a network. So that's why we were motivated to do this non-proprietary thing. The cloud computing situation seems to me very similar. We have clouds at Google, we have clouds at IBM, we have clouds at Microsoft, we have clouds at Amazon. They're all not quite the same. They're a little different, and every one of them thinks it's the only cloud in the world. We don't even have a vocabulary that says, take something from this cloud and give it to that cloud. And so one of the things that I believe we need to work on, and there are a lot of people poking around in this space, is a set of standards and protocols that allow us to move data from one cloud to another. Now, I want you to think about this for a minute, because in a lot of the cloud systems, there's access control around the data. It's metadata. We certainly try to do that at Google. We don't want everybody else reading your email except you and our programs that figure out whether or not we should put up an ad. But we don't share that with anybody else. That's all strictly internal. So the point here is that metadata has to move between the clouds. At Google, we have this data liberation idea where if you put it in, you should be able to get it back out again, and we believe in that. But I don't think that it makes sense to say, well, you know, I know you've accumulated a petabyte of data in our system, and you can easily download it to your laptop. You know, and your reaction to this is, huh? Maybe in Kansas City, but no place else, right, with the gigabit network. So the point here is that we should have the ability to say, take this data from cloud A and move it to cloud B, move all the metadata to go along with it so it's access controlled. Getting standards for how you express the metadata, how do we commonly express identifiers for people or programs or something that have access to the data, how do we make that standard? So there's a long ways to go. And if you want to get really ambitious, in theory, we should be able to run programs in multiple clouds, have data go back and forth between them, taking advantage of the particular features of each cloud to do certain kinds of computation. We don't have protocols for that either. So there's a lot of stuff we can do.
Finally, I want to mention something called delay and disruption tolerant networking. I will amplify on that if I have time in the discussion about the interplanetary internet, which I'd like to end my talk with. But just generally speaking, we have network environments now which are not always reliable. I mean, I'm setting aside the fact that we have cable cuts and things in the underlying internet. A lot of that connectivity is pretty stable. But when you have radio-based systems, your mobiles, for example, don't always get five bars. Sometimes you get 1.5, and sometimes you don't get any. Sometimes it varies. And so we have environments that are very in which connectivity is not always guaranteed. And the consequence of losing connectivity is to introduce delay, because it takes time to get back into connectivity. And so if you're trying to transmit something and you lose connectivity, in the internet world, we tend to throw stuff away, because if a packet shows up and the routing table says there ain't no way to get there, we say, well, we don't have any place to put it, and we throw it away. In delay and disruption tolerant networking, we take a different view. If the connectivity goes away, we say, okay, well, hang on to that. This, for some of you, this is kind of like message switching, if you want to go way back into history. And it's only conceivable and feasible because memory costs have come down pretty dramatically. You want to do an interesting calculation. A couple of days ago, I bought a terabyte drive for $100. You can get a three terabyte drive for $150. In 1979, I bought a 10 megabyte disk drive, 10 megabyte disk drive the size of a shoebox, for $1,000. And I was a pretty happy camper, because the alternative was 5 1/4 inch floppies, to the ceiling. So I said, gee, I wonder what would have happened if I tried to buy a terabyte of memory in 1979. And you will amuse yourselves if you do the computation. Terabyte of memory, $1,000, do the math, 10 megabytes, divide into it, it's $100 million. So I have a lot more respect now for that little 1 terabyte disk drive. I didn't have $100 million in 1979, and to be honest, I don't have $100 million now either. But I can guarantee you that if I'd had $100 million in 1979, my wife wouldn't have let me spend it on disk drives. She would have had better ideas than that. But the fact that memory is becoming very, very inexpensive allows you to consider the possibility of storing information in the net and forwarding it when connectivity becomes available, which leads me now to the interplanetary internet. I first began talking about this in late 1997, and I met with a team at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in early 1998, and we, within a few seconds of our conversation, were completing each other's sentences, because they too were thinking, how can we improve networking for space exploration? We've been using point-to-point radio links since the 1960s to communicate with spacecraft. We were thinking a lot at that time about Mars, because many missions were planned to place things in orbit around Mars, to then plan where the rovers should be landed in order to continue to explore Mars. And so we were thinking, what would happen if we had a networking capability for space exploration? So our first thought was, well, why don't we use TCP/IP? It works on Earth. It ought to work on Mars. And honestly, it would work on Mars if there's low enough latency and everything. The problem is between the planets. The speed of light is too slow. It takes 3.5 minutes to go from Earth to Mars when we're closest together, 35 million miles. It takes 20 minutes one way to go from Earth to Mars when we're farthest apart in our orbits, 235 million miles. TCP was not designed for 40-minute round-trip times. The flow control doesn't work very well. And then there's this other problem called disruption. It's planetary motion. The planets are rotating, and we haven't figured out how to stop that. So if there's something on the surface and the damn planet rotates, you can't talk to it till it comes back around again, and satellites have the same problem. So we said, okay, we have a problem, because we have variable delay in the solar system based on celestial motion, and we have this disruption caused by planetary rotation. Among other things, the rovers that are crawling around on the surface that are using radios may have the radio obscured by local features like Olympus Mons and things of that sort. Or even on the moon, we have some problems like that because of the topography. So we said, all right, we're going to have to design a new class of protocols. We started out calling them interplanetary network protocols, but we quickly recognized this was a specific case of a more general one of delay and disruption tolerance. So what has happened since that 1998 beginning is that some prototype work was done. It wasn't exactly the DTN bundle protocol, which is currently being standardized. It was a predecessor called CFDP, which is Custody File Delivery Protocol. I hate acronyms because I can't remember them anymore. This one is a store and forward design, and the model here was file transfers. Each thing that was sent was a file, and it was treated independently and separately and managed independently and separately. The delay and disruption tolerant networking protocols codify that in the form of bundles, which have variable length. On board, you remember in 1997, the little Pathfinder landed on Mars. It wasn't a very big object, but it was a pretty big step for all of us. That used point-to-point radio links direct to Earth for command and control. When the rovers landed, the ones on the lower left here in 2004, the original plan was to go direct to Earth. And when they turned the radios would be running at 28.5 kilobits a second. Of course, the scientists were all, kind of grumpy about 25.5 kilobits a second. And they turned them on, and there was an overheating problem, as I understand it. So they had to turn them off and reduce the duty cycle, which made the scientists even more grumpy. So somebody noticed that there was an X-band radio on board the rover and an X-band radio on the orbiters. Now, the orbiters had been used for mapping the surface of Mars in order to figure out where the rover should go, but that mission was completed. So the interesting possibility now was to reprogram the orbiters and the rovers to use the X-band radio to squirt information up to the orbiter as it came overhead and hold onto the data till it got to the right place in its orbit to squirt the data back to Earth, to the deep space network. These are big 70-meter dishes in three places around Earth. And that system could operate at 128 kilobits a second. First of all, the X-band radio couldn't go all the way back to Earth, but it could easily get to the orbiters. And the orbiters were outside of the atmosphere of Mars, and they had bigger solar panels. They could run at a higher signal-to-noise ratio, so they could run at 128 kilobits. My understanding is that they may even have increased that data rate now to between 256 and 512 kilobits a second. So all the data coming back from Mars is store and forward. This is like a little two-hop, three-node network. But that demonstrated the utility of store and forward networking. And when the Phoenix lander arrived in the upper right in May of 2008 at the North Pole, there was no configuration that allowed a direct-to-Earth path, so they used the store and forward method again with the CFDP protocols. And now today, as you know, there's a Mars Science lander that landed on August 5th, and it is also using these store and forward protocols in order to get back to Earth. So what we are anticipating now is a scenario in which we standardize on the bundle protocol, which codifies all this. You can just think about it as IP for space. That's really functionally what it's like. We're working with the Consultative Committee on Space Data Systems, which is a UN-based organization that standardizes protocols for space communication. We hope if they adopt these protocols that the scenario will look something like this. As we launch new missions for scientific reasons, and if those spacecraft contain the bundle protocols, then when the missions are complete, they can be repurposed as nodes of an interplanetary backbone. And that is what we hope will happen over a period of decades for the rest of the 21st century. Now, the story doesn't end there, because there's a reason to want to have that interplanetary backbone. Here's why. It turns out that DARPA has recently funded a study to design a spacecraft to get from here to the nearest star in 100 elapsed years. So this is called the 100-year spaceship. Now, there are some problems associated with getting from here to the Alpha Centauri system. The first problem is it's 4.4 light years away, And the current propulsion systems would take 65,000 years to get there. That's a little long even for a DARPA project. So, so we're going to have to find new propulsion systems that can last for 100 years' time and can propel us up to about 20% the speed of light. And by the way, when we get to the halfway mark at 50 years, we want to slow down again because otherwise we'll get one picture as we go through the, you know, really expensive photos. So we have to slow down again and get into orbit around the suns there. By the way, there has been a planet discovered in the system, and so there is something to look at besides just taking pictures of the sun. Now, that's so the propulsion is one problem. Another problem is navigation. And, the stars aren't where they look like they are because of the speed of light propagation problem. So as you're going towards Alpha Centauri, you have to do mid-course correction. But imagine you're one light year out, and we're back here trying to tell it something. It takes a year for the signal to get there and another year to find out whether or not the signal got there successfully and did it do the right thing. So this back and forth just doesn't work very well. The consequence of that is you need autonomous navigation, and I was really nervous about that, but I was told by the astronomers that we actually have a pretty good idea of the proper motion of the stars that are nearby within, say, 10 light years. So the navigation problem, autonomous navigation may not be too bad. But then there's this other problem, which is how the heck do you generate a signal that you can detect from 4 light years away? And several ideas have come along. One of them is to use a femtosecond laser. Now, think for just a minute. Maybe you have 100 watts of power. Compress 100 watts down to 10 to the minus 15 seconds in a burst. That's a pretty big peak. And although the beam will dissipate, you may still be able to detect it, which, by the way, now explains why I need an interplanetary backbone. I need a synthetic aperture receiver the size of the solar system in order to detect the signal and integrate it. Now, somebody has suggested that there might be another thing that we could do. You all understand that gravity bends light. That's what lenses do. You've heard of gravity lenses. If you get 550 AU out from the sun, you are in the place where the gravity lens is beginning to focus. And from 550 to 1,000 AU out, we've never been out that far, but if we could get out that far and put spacecraft in the right place, we could use the sun's gravity as a lens in order to focus the signal coming back from Alpha Centauri. And of course, you might even consider putting equipment at Alpha Centauri that does the same thing, to use the lens as an amplifier. So this is a study. It's a paper study. Nobody's building anything yet. But I can tell you that when you participate in projects like this, it's like living in a science fiction story. And in the end, that's what engineering is all about. It's turning science fiction into reality. And that's what we do. Thank you. Well, that was fun. It says I got 4 minutes and 36 seconds left. Maybe I have time for one question. I don't know if I have time for one answer, but I'm willing to try. Or you can let me escape and try. I'm on my way up to JPL this morning to meet with the director and the advisory committee that meets two or three times a year to look at the next kinds of projects that JPL will be proposing. So I appreciate it if you allow me to escape, but I see there is somebody in a microphone, so let's give it a shot.
Let's give it a shot.
Is this thing working? Okay. The reason I'm doing this is not because I'm coming to spit on you, it's because I'm hearing impaired, and it makes it easier for me to lip read in case I have to. So don't hide behind the microphone.
Oh, okay. Name's Patrick Cable, MIT Lincoln Laboratory. I was curious, when you mentioned earlier about the ITU getting into the content business, regulating spam, so on and so forth, and what the implications are for countries that go forth and do that, like as we have here, and your thoughts about regulation in general. Should we stay hands-off, or are there quote-unquote good regulations that make sense?
So that's a fair question. I realize I'm now speaking from my backside to people over here. The old fart is still farting right now. Well, this is slightly better. Thank you. I don't mean to just walk away from you. That's a good question. So the short story is that these are real problems. I mean, we cannot ignore spam. We cannot ignore viruses and worms and all this stuff. So we really have to do something about it. But I'm not sure that international regulation is the right tactic. A lot of the response tends to have to be local, but some of it may require international agreement. So I'm actually not opposed to having international agreements about things that we collectively consider to be unacceptable behavior. Spam might be a good example of that, viruses and worms and other things. I think we will need international agreements in order to empower countries on a bilateral or multilateral basis to act together. But I want to emphasize something very important about the internet and its character, and what we've learned about creating a system like this, which has survived this amount of time in a very resilient way. Informality is sometimes your friend. When the Conficker worm showed up, an informal working group made up of a number of different organizations that did not have any formal relations participated and continued to participate. The informality allowed that to happen. And IETF is another good example. You can't join the IETF. There's no place to sign up. You have to show up. And that's it. You show up, you speak your piece, people who agree with you will support your ideas, and people that don't won't. But the whole point here is that some informality may turn out to be the best tactic. I'm sorry that's all the time I had, but it's a good question. Thank you for allowing me to take up time this morning. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Got it?